Welcome back to Canon Law. We must be, as I was saying to some people earlier, there must be something wrong with us to be sitting inside like this in such a beautiful place. I guess that's because of my perspective coming from the East Coast, where it's right now, you know, like 25 degrees. Coming over here and experiencing weather that's 50 degrees warmer. You want to talk about a change of circumstances. What? There's a downside to everything, I guess. So what I'd like to do now, it's absolutely, we've gone through, we've talked about the definition of canon law, we've talked about theological nature of canon law, we've talked about some of the questions that come up from that theological nature, what naturally arises when we reflect theologically, how we have to different dimensions, especially if we're posing problems. And we've talked about some of the problems of appropriation, making the canons our own today. And we've begun to talk about the history of canon law within the church, the standards, right? Because that's what we're talking about. If we go back to Matthew Vlastaris, or Vlastaris, the 14th century higher monk who does the canon law encyclopedia, we all say, wouldn't that be wonderful? Wouldn't that be wonderful to have a canon law encyclopedia that'd be available, universally accepted by our church, and that our hierarchy could use as a guide for themselves to understand the canons, for us to understand? Wouldn't it be wonderful if we had this, we updated this understanding that we had of the formal corpus of canon law? All right, so we have these theological reflections, this definition. Now what I'd like to do is actually engage with the sources. Coming here, a woman asked me on the airplane, I was talking with her about what I was going to do here. Very interesting woman, works for the Obama administration, very practical. She goes, "What's a canon? Give me an example." Well, I'd like to get to that point. So I thought we'd do as, so we're going to have these case studies. We'll try to get through as much of them as we can before 12 o'clock. We are not going to be able to do all of them, but the way I'm going to do them is I'm going to read you part of the case study, and I'd like to ask you to discuss. Okay? Now, who here has the book with them? All right? We have some people with the book with them. Who here has the handout? Lucky enough, I have reproduced these four case studies in the handout. So if you have the book, follow along. If you have the handout, follow along. But what I'd like you all to turn to is case study one. Case study one. So look to that. And it would be on page 6 of the book. So I talked about frameworks, right? And I showed you the example of St. Nicodemus of the Holy Mount. He constructed a framework, basically brought together canons all dealing with the same subject, so it addressed different aspects of the same subject, something coherent that you could put your hands to, and then you would have an idea of how to deal with that issue. Very handy for hierarchs to consider, very handy for you to consider. So I have an example of one that I constructed on an issue that touches everybody in this room if you are either married or celibate. Deals with marriage and celibacy, right? And it deals with the clergy. So the first one, and this is the framework. So if you notice the way it's set up, I give you enough background. I've summarized the background to make it to make you dangerous. It's all what I just said today, okay? I'm talking about the way canons, frameworks are constructed. But this one talks about the framework of canons governing clergy and marriage. So it's a short synopsis. Now notice, a reminder, canons are referred to by their source, which is what? If they're councils, what are we referring to? Location, place name. Nicaea, Constantinople, Ephesus, where are all these places located? They're located in Asia Minor, that were present-day Asia Minor. Ephesus, located there. And also, what's the alternative in Orthodox tradition besides besides location? Number of fathers. Number of fathers traditionally that the hierarchs. That emphasizes what? Decision made in hierarchy on the model of the council in Jerusalem and the affirmation that it's being done under the guidance of the Holy Spirit. You have hierarchs making the decisions. That's why it's done that way. And so if you go to ancient orders of the canons, you will find them listed according to the number of hierarchs. So we have here the canons, the framework of canons governing clergy and marriage. And what I have done for every single statement, and this is what I do when I construct these things, for every single statement, I have a footnote. So let's take the first one. The legislation, I'll read it. The legislation governing, this is under framework of canons governing clergy and marriage. The legislation governing marriage and clergy treated by Orthodox canonical sources may be briefly summarized as a whole. So I'm going to summarize. In general, no male may be ordained who has married twice after baptism, although if remarriage occurs before the sacrament, mystery, there does not appear to be a restriction on the reception of orders as long as only one union is maintained. Footnote, Holy Apostles 17. What drives me crazy, by the way, when my students give me papers, because they're relying on the Nicene, post-Nicene Father series, there's a volume that is dedicated to the canons. All of the canons there are in what? They're in Roman numerals. So they think they're being Orthodox and using Roman numerals. I'm here to tell you that I prefer the Arabic numerals. Okay, Arabi, okay, Arabic numerals. Okay, so we have Holy Apostles 17. What is the Holy Apostles? Anyone could tell me? It is at the head of every canonical collection in the Orthodox Church. Holy Apostles, ecumenical councils, local councils, and patristic texts regarding this having canonical authorities. Those are the four sources, main sources of the formal corpus of canon law. And Holy Apostles is here, it's first in order, and Holy Apostles 17, Basil, St. Basil the Great, Canon 12, Trullo, the Council in Trullo, we remember this, part of what council? What is regarded as officially part of? Sixth. Six, it provides canons to what? Fifth and sixth, and it's known as Pinthecti. So you have these three sources for that statement, solidly based in that statement. That is what that means right there. Okay, so you've got this idea of married twice after baptism, and you've got reception of orders based on one union. Now, next statement. The prohibition on ordination also includes those who live with a concubine after rites of initiation. What is a concubine? Someone you are not married to, okay? If you live with someone after being baptized, according to canons 17 of the Holy Apostles and Trullo 3, you should not be a priest. Next statement. Matrimony must take place prior to ordination for all clergy above the ranks of reader and chanter. And I have footnoted Holy Apostles 26, Canon 26, Neo Caesarea, local council, Canon 1, St. Basil the Great, Canon 6, Carthage. Carthage is actually the North African legislation, right? It's a body of legislation. Actually, it's composed of several councils that are compiled. Canon 16 and Trullo 6. Trullo 6. And we all know what Trullo is now, right? Okay, all based on that statement. This restriction, now here comes the thing that always elicits a response from Antiochians. This restriction applies to subdeacons, deacons, and presbyters. Right? In formal legislation, the restriction of subdeacon, it's a difference. It's a difference between the practice of Antioch and the practice of Constantinople. It's a difference. Does it that subdeacons, you can have a subdeacon, and if they're not married before they become a subdeacon, they're not supposed to marry afterwards, according to Constantinople. Constantinople's the difference. They maintain that they are, in fact, they maintain a discipline that they are, in fact, some form of ordination. It's a difference. Is it illegitimate? No. It's a difference. It's a variety. It's a variance. Does it mean that there can't be a variance? No, it doesn't mean there can't be a variance. They're both legitimate, in my viewpoint. They're both legitimate approaches. Yes?
But why did they put a subdiaconal orarium on little boys in the altar in the Greek genome?
I know. There's the same, again, a difference. Has it led to the churches breaking communion with each other?
No. But I mean, they get married.
We can go back and forth on it. Do the churches receive their different practices on this as manifested by their continued communion with one another? Yes. For example, Constantinople crowned second marriages. Constantinople crowned second marriages in the middle Byzantine, in the Byzantine period, late Byzantine period. Others don't. Do they continue to receive each other? Does variance receive? Yes. Does the variance mean something? And I guess this is the point, and this has to be the point. Can, given the circumstances, the truth be expressed according to the discretion of the hierarchy of that church in a different manner? Yes, it can be. On issues that are obviously ones that will not cause them to actually break communion with one another, they continue to receive each other. We must, as Orthodox, also come out of the idea, at least in terms of local churches, that, and when I say local churches, autocephalous churches, that there has to be absolute consistency between all, on every single thing. There does not. But there has to be consistency on significant things. The OCA and the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese, Constantinople's difference on the reception of converts is a significant thing. It hasn't led to a break in communion yet, but I put it to you that the underlying understanding of marriage may. And that's where we are talking about. Is there something different about ordination being understood? I don't think so. I think we understand who is a priest and who is not a priest between Constantinople and Antioch. However, there may be a problem in understanding who is married between Constantinople and the OCA, because underlying it is an understanding of the meaning of the word regarding marriage, of the place of epiklesis with regard to the marriage. Is it necessary for marriage to take place with an epiklesis, the crowning, or simply by receiving communion together. That's really an underlying theological issue, because the OCA is highly influenced by theological thought that was articulated at St. Vladimir's that put an emphasis on the Eucharist as constitutive element of marriage, and it's reflected in practice, whereas this emphasis does not exist in the patriarchate, in the ecumenical patriarchate, with regard to the reception of converts, which is based on 19th century Holy Synod decisions about the way in which they should be received. Anyway, that's what it usually does come up, because this is a variance, and I don't see it as a major issue. I don't, but it's my theological, that's my canonical opinion. I leave it to hierarchs to make the decision.
Did it have something to do with the historical development of the sacrament of ecumenicalism in the 7th century as the growing separation from the Eucharist?
See, that's why I will cover this, because I don't believe that's actually. But I do want to say that I believe that the Antiochian practice is authentic. It's an expression of truth. The other practice, within the other local church, is expression of what is being expressed. And I don't think that they are something that should rupture anything. Let's go to the next one. Candidates for the priesthood are forbidden to marry certain categories of women, to include widows, prostitutes, actresses, slaves, employees of inns, and others generally not believed to be chaste. These are the so-called listed women. That's what they're called. They are the listed women. And that's based on Holy Apostles 18, Trullo 3, and there's a summary of the legislation in what? The Nomo Canon of 14 titles. Now, we're going to cover what that is, but I'll tell you just enough to make it dangerous to you. We're celebrating St. Photius the Great today. St. Photius is attributed the authorship of the Nomo Canon, 14 titles. It combines what? The law of the time and canon law together in one place, and it is regarded as authoritative collection for the Christian East. One of the most authoritative collections of law and canon for the Christian East. And I translate a text that is very key here in putting forth the idea of that. Bishops are required to be celibate. That's Trullo 12, Trullo 48. But we say, compare it to Holy Apostles 5, which says the opposite. We'll deal with that. Okay, so I think I've gone through enough. We go through all of these canons. These are all canons that say what basically I'm summarizing here. And I guess let's deal with these questions now. I would like to hear your thoughts. Why? Why would canons separated by time and space have any relationship to one another? Trullo occurs in what year? 691, 692, right? Holy Apostles are said, it's actually produced in Syria in the 4th century. That's Orthodox canonical scholarship. Orthodox canonical scholarship. Why do they have any relationship to one another? Anyone want to hazard a theological thought on this matter? Some of you have theological training. I'm open to all kind of ideas here. What do you think? What? Well, we want to talk about the Holy Spirit, but how about this idea? What do you think of this? They're all listed. If you go to, remember those canons I'd said in Trullo that listed all of these councils? What are they doing? If they list them all together, if you collect them all together, what are you trying to say? You are trying to say that we receive them as one formal body of legislation. That is an assumption that is being made here. And it may not be apparent because we're just making that assumption. It's one formal body. And that's what raises all these questions about the conflict. They don't seem to be relevant, some of them. And then some of them continue to be very relevant. And some of them have, you know, the way they're used in the church, the meaning has changed. But that's the assumption. That's why, despite the fact they're separated by time and space, they're one formal body. Okay. Another question. Are these frameworks that I'm talking about, this framework, are they constructed or do they already exist in the church's life? What do you think? Yeah.
Would it be legitimate to compare this to the Creed, the Nicene Creed? Is the Nicene Creed saying something that the church just now started to believe in? Or is it articulating something we always believe, putting it in words that we can have for?
Precisely. I would say that, I'll say you're on to something. In other words, they do interrelate to one another. They do express something. They would have no worth in the construction if they did not refer to each other either explicitly in the canon itself or by the fact that they are related to one another in the way that the church lives its life. So there's an explicit reference. If you go into Trullo, for example, they'll say, and we are saying what St. Basil said. That's explicit. But then there's something that is what you're talking about. They are related to one another. So if we are talking about the celibacy of bishops, for example, we have to consider Holy Apostles 5, and we have to and that canon is explaining why bishops are celibate. And it's related to another canon, Trullo 48, which talks about monastic tonsure and the acceptance of tonsure by the wife, the already existing wife of a bishop, of someone that's a candidate for the episcopacy. Yeah, I think you're on to something. Any other thoughts?
So in other words, making it explicit what is implicit.
Yes. Which is, I think, very orthodox in its approach. So what is the purpose of constructing a framework? Why did St. Nicodemus of the Holy Mountain in the 18th century just start listing the canons and stuff? What is the purpose of doing it? What do you think? Is a practical matter. If you're going to make a decision about something, aren't you going to want to know about what's involved? Don't you want to have an idea of the whole thing? So it's a tool. It gives us an idea of covering every dimension of a specific point. But it also points to something that is a problematic thing. It reflects the fact, if I'm going to be forced to do this, if I'm forced to do this, if St. Nicodemus of the Holy Mountain is forced to do that, it reflects an unmet need of the church to truly look at its formal corpus of canon law, the holy apostles, the commitment councils, the local councils, the patristic texts that have canonical authority, and to have an understanding of them as an Orthodox church. In other words, to appropriate them now. So what we're doing when we do a framework, when a canonist like myself does a framework, is what I'm trying to do something that makes up for that. And I'm trying to relate them to all to one another in the footnotes. And I've got to explain variances between Antioch and Constantinople. And I've got to do it to the satisfaction of the hierarchs who are making decisions. So it's a tool. It's a very good tool, but it also, it has its good side and its bad side. Everybody understand? All right. Why don't we go to case study two? Okay. Here we have two examples, one of which has sort of relevance right now. Well, they both have relevance. One deals with the discussion of the council in Carthage by who? Matthew of Lestoris. Who is Matthew of Lestoris? Anybody? Law studies? Hieromonk. What does he do? What's he write? Yeah, he does an encyclopedia. Encyclopedia. Wouldn't it be nice to have that? Okay, so he's discussing council in Carthage. I'll summarize it because we're running out of time here in this one, but I want you to read the deaconess one. The Council of Carthage, he talks about it. Now it's where he says, Council of Carthage, which had Scipion the Great as an exarch. Exarch is, let's just say that is a leader. It is the presider over the council. Is that a principle of Orthodox canon law that you have to have someone, a bishop that presides over a council? Yes. You can see it in Apostolic Canon 34, which is translated in the book, in the penance, which talks about someone leading the council. It's founded in what? If we see the Council of Jerusalem, who is the leader there?
James.
James, right. This is apostolic. This is the way we do our church. This is the way things are done. So Cyprian is the exarch. He is leading a council. It is recorded to be more ancient than all the ecumenical and local councils. It numbered 84 bishops. That's important. Why is that important? 84? Conciliarity? Right. Decisions made in hierarchy under the guidance of the Holy Spirit based on the apostolic ministry. You want a list that you had bishops there. It's not 84 bishops and 5 deacons. It's 84 bishops. Okay. Indeed, they produce one decision in the form of a canon that those baptized by heretics and schismatics who enter the Catholic Church were to be baptized again. Okay? And what are they talking about? They're talking about a guy named Novatian. Does anyone know anything about Novatian? He was the leader of a rigorous heresy. Yeah. If you, under persecution, gave away the church's gospels and sacred vessels to the Roman state, should you be received back to communion? Well, okay. And if I commune with that person, what does that make me? Okay. So they made a decision that those who were baptized by heretics and schismatics who enter the Catholic Church, Catholic meaning what? Roman Catholic? No. Orthodox. By the way, Theodore Balsamon, the Patriarch of Antioch, when he speaks of us, and he's talking about Rome, he never uses the word Orthodox in his answers. What word does he use?
Catholic.
We are the Catholic Church. That's our word. You know, when I'm in the Catholic Orthodox dialogue, I always call them Roman Catholics. They hate it. They hate it. I don't want to use the word Latin, which is the word that, because they've abandoned their language anyway, but Latin, you know, that's the word that Balsamon used. I'm not trying to be derogatory, but we are the Catholic Church, the Church of the Ecumenical, the Universal Church, one holy Catholic apostolic. Catholic Church, that's our word, that's Blastoria's word, and that should be the way we refer to ourselves when we think of ourselves. At least let us think ourselves that way. Catholic Church. Okay, so now we're talking about where to be baptized again. Now we're talking about, now he's got to account for something, because that's not what they do. That's not what the church does since this time of Carthage. There are some people that are simply not baptized again, and he has to explain it. He says, he explains it in three different ways. St. Basil the Great made mention of this decree in his Canon 1, citing of an approval, but at the same time decreeing it null. null on account of what? The exercise of economy. In other words, the hierarchs in applying the canons made decisions about how made decisions about how they would be received. And not everyone is being baptized. Okay? Baptized, again, is probably a misnomer, even though he's talking about, in other words, the idea is you're being first baptized. Okay? And they're saying the hierarchs are making a decision based on hierarchy. Not everyone is going to be baptized when they enter the Catholic Church if they're a heretic or schismatic. And then Second Ecumenical Council in Canon 7 decreed against it, saying this is not the standard. We don't baptize all that are from heresies and schisms. We may baptize some, but we don't baptize all. On account of this, mark you, the Sixth Ecumenical Council, what are we talking about? Are we talking about 681, which is the, or are we talking about 691, Trullo? Trullo? Trullo, yes. Sixth Ecumenical Council, so that's Trullo, which is an extension of 681. So 10 years later, 681, 691. He stated that the canon which had been set forth by these fathers prevailed only in their localities. It's a local council. So what this says to us is that the church accepted that some of these canons from local councils prevail in locally at that time for those circumstances, but do not have universal significance. Some of them do. But they form what? One, they're part of one formal body of canon law. That's the assumption. One formal body that they list. All right, so prevailed only in the localities and according to the custom handed down to them. Here is the key point, and he makes this point. For this canon, as it appeared, followed logically from the circumstances at that time. Wherefore, the changing of these circumstances also changed this canon to no longer be in effect. In other words, it expressed the truth. It's incarnational. It expressed the truth at that time, but when the circumstances of time changed, it no longer expressed the truth. And the church, under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, made decisions in hierarchy based on the apostolic ministry to make changes. Changes can occur within the church, but it occurs within this framework. Okay, we have exactly what? 10 minutes? Can we discuss deaconesses?
Can you just make it a point to stay as close to the microphone for the sake of the recording?
Okay. I've been told to be close to the microphone. It's not because I love the hearing of my own voice, though some people think that. But I will. So we have deaconesses. Big letter sent out to throughout the country from a friend of mine, Father Alexander Webster. Father Alexander Webster sent out to the members of the Orthodox Theological Society of America saying that, isn't it terrible to have deaconesses in the church? Which church is involved with deaconesses right now? Right. Who made that decision? The hierarchy. The Orthodox Theological Society of America responds, saying we're going to have an upcoming meeting. Such discussion creates problems. We don't like this discussion. All right, so now you've got two groups of theologians kind of duking it out. Here we have a text from Matthew of Listoris, 14th century, describing something. Okay, what is the problem that he has? What is Bless Doris. He's trying to express the church's canonical thought and theological thought on stuff. And he has come across something. And what is his problem? His problem is he's come across texts that describe something that doesn't exist in his time. He's got councils talking about the age requirements for the ordination of deaconesses, ecumenical councils. He's got solid liturgical texts. He has to explain why they don't exist. And so he's saying, he's got to acknowledge the problem. Furthermore, the most ancient books in which the rites of all ordinations have been accurately recorded also indicate the age of a deaconess must be 40, that her schema, that's an important word, schema. What's a schema? You would think, but not. Schema is also used for lay people. What does it reflect? It reflects not only clothing, but that it reflects status in life. It's a technical term used in canon law, so do not get caught in the trap of thinking it's just monastic. It can be lay schema. It reflects our position within the church, our rank within the church, but not in the sense of, you know, like being a sergeant in the army. It's more relational, if we want to think of it that way. So schema must be monastic and perfect, that during her life she must contend for virtue with the most excellent of men, and that as much as solemnized in her ordination, short of a little, is also celebrated in the case of male deacons. Now he has to explain why they don't exist. So he comes to this and he says, okay, just summarizing, they used to be in baptizing with women. For what? Moral purposes, because the women were naked, right? And you couldn't have men baptizing them. And then he said that women deacons were later forbidden by the fathers to both enter the altar and to practice the things of their ministry because of what? Blood. Blood. Menarche. There's blood involved. And that the holy altar was formally accessible to women, he refers to the funeral oration of St. Gregory the Theologian that he made upon her sister. And in that funeral oration, he describes what? The sister embracing the altar, putting her hair on the altar. So what does this illustrate? A change of circumstances resulted in disuse. He also provides, and this is very telling, a theological idea that there was impurity involved with the blood. I put it to you, and this is how we'll end, that idea about impurity may be something that is more circumstantial. May be something that is founded more in Hellenistic science with regard to birth and the corruption of blood than it is to, and it might be involved in evolving ideas of purity and impurity, than it is in the expression of the nature of diaconate. And a decision being made by hierarchs in Alexandria regarding deaconesses may be in some way going back to this institution which has canonical legislation concerning it, and simply based on discretion, based on their apostolic ministry, making decisions about ways in which the church can use deaconesses once more for very practical purposes. Case study. Anyway, the overall conclusion is to affirm, I think, what I'm trying to do is affirm the incarnational nature of canon law. And that's the point I'm trying to get across. We don't have time for these two other case studies. Maybe we can continue our discussion. It's 12 o'clock, I think, right? Yeah, we have to go to lunch. When I come back, I'll give you a choice of either me continuing with the history of the church, this legal history, or we can get into more case studies.